I'm Roger Malco, in case you don't know who I am.
I am Roger.
I'm going to talk about generative modeling. We're going to do three lectures on generative modeling, which is a subset of unsupervised learning. And I'm going to take the approach of aiming to sort of teach the foundations of some of the work that we've been doing in generating quantum wave functions through unsupervised learning and generative modeling. So the first couple of lectures will go through the basics of generative modeling, talk about the basic technique that we use for unsupervised learning with restricted Bolson machines. We'll derive the training procedure for those things. And in the last lecture on Wednesday, I'll talk a little bit about how we generalize from the classical world of data to the data that we receive from quantum devices, which will involve, you know, I guess, further generalizations of the Bolson machine that we'll talk about. But so just a step back, what we're doing is unsupervised learning. So let's review what unsupervised learning is, just for about 2 minutes here. It aims to model the underlying structure of some data set. Okay, so we receive a set of data from, I don't know, some device, some object, some data set on the internet, something like that. And what we want to do is model the structure of the data, but we don't have labels. Okay, so unlike supervised learning, all of our data is unlabeled. Like the vast majority of data out there in the world. With Lauren, you talked about some examples of unsupervised learning, in particular clustering. Clustering aims to take unlabeled data and perform some procedure that shows you relationships between different elements of that data set. Okay? So you might imagine some projection of data into some lower dimensional space, like t-SNE or something like that, that takes all this higher dimensional distances between data and preserves them in this lower dimensional projection, for example. So looking for inherent groupings, say. This is powerful in physics applications too. Most of our data, of course, produced by devices and experiments and so on would be unlabeled. And you may want to find out, for example, I don't know, if different subsets of your data correspond to different positions on a phase diagram or something like that. So these could be different phases, paramagnet, ferromagnet, whatever. These could be cats versus dogs versus hamsters. So you get the idea. So the idea of clustering is just that, you know, you somehow look for these groupings without the labels, and perhaps then you can do some other technique to infer labels or infer some sort of qualities of these groups afterwards. Association. Association is just simply looking for relationships between different elements of your data set or different variables. So for example, recommender systems use this. If you like, I don't know, X, you will also like Y. So the idea that, you know, you might train basically some sort of generative model on all of the X that you, group into some classification, and it can make recommendations that you might also like Y. Or you might be looking for these associations between groups. You might think of looking for, I don't know, a correlation between different, spins on a lattice or different qubits or something like that. So association is, you know, there's lots of different manifestations of this. We will tackle this a little bit with generative modeling. So the point is that there's lots of different goals of unsupervised learning, right? It's like I said, one of the biggest, I think, fields of machine learning, because so much of our data is unlabeled. So I'm not going to talk about clustering. I'll talk a bit about association, but we're going to discuss all of these in the context of generative modeling. So you've looked at generative modeling a little bit with Lauren. Let me review a couple things. The way I'm going to think about generative modeling is that we have some sort of black box, which I'm going to consider like an experiment, maybe a quantum computer. And in that black box, I have an underlying probability distribution or a wave function or a state of the system or something like that. In the classical world, I'm going to call this a probability distribution, big P. And what P is doing is producing data. So we're going to have a data set. Uh-oh. That's taken as given for free from this black box. Okay, so we're given I'm going to assume binary data, which I think you guys have been using. I'll call it X. It's a configuration produced by that machine. And the data that I'm talking about is the set of all X produced according to that underlying distribution, which, by the way, is unknown. So P could have some analytical form, but you don't know what it is. Okay, so. Each X variable is a bit, or the projective measurement of a qubit. Think of it like that. So here's n bits. And the set of data that comes from that black box also labeled with D. And is that vector. So I'm going to abuse notation, but each one of these is labeling, say, the n different bits or qubits of the machine, just a way of thinking of keeping this notation distinct. And I'll have a data set, which I'll probably just write like this most of the time, which is actually a set of these data vectors, 1, 2, M. So M is the size of your training set, right? Or the number of measurements that you've performed or something like that. What distinguishes this from reinforcement learning, which you talked about last week, I think, is that this data is assumed to be given to us by free, given to us for free, okay? Which might not be true if you're building one of these experiments, but that's kind of one of the things that distinguishes unsupervised learning from reinforcement learning. So there's no cost associated with producing that data set in our algorithm. Okay. So this data set D is distributed according to P. of x. And what we want to know is if we can discover an approximation to big P of x, you know, given only that data set. And that's basically what generative modeling is. I'm going to call it small p, just to confuse everyone. But I'll label these more precisely when, as we go on. Can we discover an approximation small p from the data alone? So this is our approximation. And this is the unknown probability distribution that underlies the data set. Cool? So far, so good. What's the simplest way to do this? The simplest way to model a probability distribution from a set of data is to literally just build the frequency distribution, right? You know what I mean? You just have a frequency of data. Oh, I don't know how to spell naive. Simplest way. What is the frequency distribution? That's small p, which is my approximation. It's approximately given by, I'll say, big P data, which is just 1 over the size of the data set. I'm going to label the data with k delta x x k. It's really just memorizing the training set. What's the problem with that?
The set might be very large.
What's that?
You might have a lot of data. You might not want to like store it all.
That's one problem. We usually think of the other problem, where you don't have enough data.
Oh.
There's holes between all the data.
Right.
Yeah, or the data is continuous and you don't hit it perfectly.
That's right, too.
Not very good at generalizing.
Yeah, those are all right. So you're all right in your own way. So if your data is huge, it's the tomography problem, right? If you have too many qubits, this doesn't make any sense, right? If you have too many qubits, what it really means is your Hilbert space is too big, which means you can never take enough data basically to cover all of the parts of that distribution in some sense. So typically what happens is not that sum is too big to perform, but that you don't have enough data to properly represent, or to properly cover your state space or something like that. So then you don't get good generalization. So, and you can just imagine, like you were saying, you have a histogram of P data. But imagine that, you know, here's one, here's two. You know, you had a bunch of ones, you had a couple twos. If this histogram's too, I guess, sparse, I don't know if that's the right word, then if you want to approximate, you know, so if you want to somehow take an unknown or unseen element and ask what the probability of that element occurring is. If it falls somehow in between here, or if this frequency isn't high enough that you, you know, you're faithfully representing some underlying distribution, right? So what if P of X, you know, looked like this? What if that's big P of X? So if you don't have enough data, this will be a bad generalization of the task. So generative modeling aims to fix this problem. It aims to find a small p of x that somehow, number one, solves this problem of generalization, which means you can infer a correct probability distribution for an element of data or a configuration or a single value of x, which isn't seen in the training set. And you also can use generative modeling to produce a new configuration that hasn't been seen before, like one of these things that hasn't been seen in the training set. So by generalize well, I mean give an accurate estimate for p of x when x is not in the data set. I don't know the symbol for that. Not in D. And you want the generative model to also make novel samples. That's the generative part, right? You can generate new configurations x that approximately fall under the underlying unknown big P of x. So the procedure is not to use the frequency distribution, but to parameterize a model. Okay, so now you introduce a model. It's kind of a common theme, right? You have to find some way of modeling your data, and you want to do it in a very generic way that you can transfer between different types of data sets and so on. And that model will give you all these generalization properties. Okay. So I'll say model, I don't know, P data with some parameters lambda. You do this all the time in physics. The difference in machine learning is just the idea that, you know, these parameters are going to be something that's sort of very generic, like I say. And so these are going to be the weights and biases of your neural network, just looking ahead. Okay. So what we need to do is define a training procedure where we take the data, we take a neural network, we feed in all that data, and we somehow tune the weights and biases of the neural network so that, you know, P of lambda is approximately equal to P of data. So that's the like learning. Take the data, tune lambda so that in a way that generalizes well. And remember, we're only given a training set in D. So let's work on our models. So we'll use these energy-based models, which are basically just graphical representations of probability distributions. So these have a history in machine learning dating back to the 80s with basically John Hopfield's network. So the first one, almost just for historical purposes, but not quite. Is the Hopfield network. John Hopfield is a condensed matter theorist who's emeritus at Princeton, I believe. He was Bert Halperin's PhD advisor and also Steve Gervin's PhD advisor. So he came up with the idea of essentially a physics-based or a physics-inspired sort of generative model, which can be seen as a graphical probability distribution. So as a physicist, the idea that you have a probability distribution defined by an energy functional was familiar to him. Let me just write it like this. X are binary variables, just like up there. I could have something that looks like this, maybe a field. And what you see is an energy of an Ising model. So let me define the graph first. The Hopfield network. So if you have n qubits or n bits, so you have n nodes in the graph, and those nodes each have a binary variable, so xi is 0 or 1. Each binary variable is connected by a weight. That's supposed to be a different color. Okay. So here's xi. Xj, Wij, and you can also have a bias term, which I've written as B. But as you can see, this is just an Ising model with a magnetic field.
Oops.
So the probability distribution defined with the Hopfield network is just what I'm calling P of lambda. It's just the usual Boltzmann distribution, like that, where z is the usual partition function. Or the normalization constant. And from this graph, you see that it's just fully connected. A fully connected Ising model with magnetic field terms is what we call the biases. So the weight matrix is fully symmetric. That's like the Jij of your Ising model, which we call Wij. So the only point of this is that, you know, this is a perfectly valid representation of a probability distribution, right? So in principle, you can imagine simulating the modeling the P of X that underlies some data set with just some network like this. And the learning procedure would be to, you know, adjust the weights and biases so that some of these interactions are more you know, prevalent than others. And Hopfield originally, you know, motivated by condensed matter physics, was essentially using this to model associative memory. So a memory in this kind of network, you can imagine as a local minimum. So local minimum or memories, the forgetting procedure would be, you know, if you somehow, you know, your free energy, if you will, rolled away from one of the local minima. He defined a learning procedure, an optimization procedure, which would bring back the state of the machine to these local memories. But the big thing is the idea of mapping, you know, the learning problem to an optimization problem in this kind of landscape. The idea of optimizing is what you've seen before. It's somehow finding the correct lambda that give you the P of lambda x as close as possible to, say, P data in a way that generalizes well. Hopfield networks are essentially impossible to train. Question?
Where p data is the simple frequency about probability distribution.
Yeah, so p data is just I'd say there's p, and that's approximated by p data. In case your data set is incomplete.
Which is the frequency distribution we were talking about before.
You define p data over here to be the sum of the deltas.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
You're using capital P just for the underlying unknown set.
So. Forget data then, since I've defined it over there. What I want is a p lambda that approximates p. I'm assuming that I can't calculate p data or something like that. But
so, what are you using to train?
It'll be p data, but they're okay. I mean, it's all the same thing. But I'm just saying, think of it as I'm not going to calculate the frequency distribution exactly. Yeah. I'm going to calculate a parameterized model. So it might not give you a perfect frequency distribution. So it might not give you,
right.
You know, the perfect frequency distribution. So this should be approximate. But we'll use only the data in training it. Yeah. But in terms of generative modeling, you're hoping that it gives a better model of P of X than P data defined by the frequency distribution would. Otherwise, you would use the frequency distribution. So just philosophically, think of it like this. This is supposed to be small. The point of Hopfield networks is they don't train. Otherwise, you might use them. A generalization of a Hopfield network introduced by Hinton and others.
Does it not train because it's hard to optimize over this landscape?
Or? Right.
Okay.
Yeah, the minimization procedure doesn't work, basically. So part of the whole, all of the art of the state of the art in this stuff is going to be about training the model. I mean, this thing is a great way of parameterizing the distribution. There's more another problem with this, from what I gather, I've never used one, is it doesn't generalize well in terms of a representation, but that's, I'd say, typically not the machinery that we're learning here. The machinery that we're learning is ways of training these models. So, the idea of backprop, right? The idea that backprop works in some sort of like scalable time, that's why we talk about machine learning. Otherwise, this is just an abstract way of representing a probability distribution. A generalization of this, which doesn't train well, is called the Boltzmann machine. The only difference between a Boltzmann machine and a Hopfield network is that you've added additional representation capacity. in the sense of a hidden or latent space. Okay, so why would you want to do that? It's basically the idea that there might be correlations. So there might be correlations which are difficult to model with a Hopf field network. Of a
correlation that'd be difficult to model.
I would say long range stuff. And I'll show you why. So let me write a Boltzmann machine. So here I'm gonna write visible units and hidden units. So these are visible, hidden. The Hopf field was all visible. So there's n of these, the number of qubits. So in principle, these are all still fully connected if you want. There's other ways of doing these, I'm sure. There's hidden layers. A fully connected machine would also have connected hidden layers. So these are the weights I'm drawing. But a Boltzmann machine also connects visible and hidden in a fully connected way. OK, so it's a big mess. There's 5 qubits and 4. So you know, n equals 4. I don't know what you call this. Number of hidden equals, 5 and 4. So the point is that if you have a correlation between, I don't know, this variable and this variable, which is encoded by this weight here. You can also encode that by weights which go up through the visible layer, through the hidden layer here. So the observation is that you've basically increased the number of parameters in the machine. You sort of increase the idea, you've increased the number of and type of probability distributions that can be represented. They also call this expressiveness in machine learning. And with this increased parameterization brings the idea that maybe you can move around optimization space, and you've expanded the number of dimensions in your space, and you can possibly move around easier and learn these weights easier than that one. Do you have another question?
No.
It's not obvious?
Maybe it just wasn't like why you would want these connections to model this connection. I mean, yeah, I guess adding more parameters makes something easier to fit.
Adding more parameters, you're fitting. there's 3 parameters that you can use to model those connections now. So you'd have to spread the weight out between them. But the real reason I think the study of Boltzmann machine, again, this is just I'm kind of like systematically building it up, is the idea that we're going to take away all the visible and hidden intralayer connections now. So if I take away these connections here and these connections here, I need to have this hidden layer in order to model those correlations. And that's important for the learning procedure that I'm going to define next.
So is this like an energy-based model, the Boltzmann machine?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely.
So, but we don't know like sort of the values of the hidden units as opposed to the values of the visible units.
Right. They're still binary units, but they're in a latent space that isn't, part of the physical data set.
So how do we calculate the energy to them?
Okay. We will do that now. So let me just move on to RBMs, and I'll show you how to do that. So what I'm going to say about RBMs in terms of the energy-based model is the same for this Boltzmann machine. But all I'm doing is I'm just going to focus on the case that has a good learning, an efficient learning procedure. Okay. So you can imagine doing a lot of what I'm doing here, except it won't work. So restricted bulls. Restricted, that's what the R stands for. So what I want you to take away from this is the idea that you've increased the number of parameters, you've increased the representational or the expressiveness, representational power, the expressiveness of the machine. In a restricted Boltzmann machine, you know, in principle, you're gonna take away some of that expressive power. But you're gonna be glad you did. So there's visibles, there's hiddens. Each one of these are binary units. But they're only connected between the layers. However that looks. Okay? Only is it intra. Only intra-layer connections. And one thing you're allowed to do in both the Boltzmann machine and the restricted Boltzmann machine is change the number of hidden units. And so that's how you control basically the expressiveness of your machine. So this is fixed. You know, here it's n equals 5, but this is, you know, variable. It's a hyperparameter. If you have a data set that's very, I don't know, simple somehow, you can imagine getting away with very few hidden units. I'm thinking quantum mechanically. If you have something with like long-range entanglement or long-range correlations in a classical system, something at a critical point, as we'll see, then you have to increase the number of hidden units. So I think in terms of physical applications, imagine that you have a number of, looking ahead, a number of physical qubits, and you want to ask, how does this representation of the underlying, say, wave function scale? What you really have to ask is, how do you scale the number of hidden units with the number of visible units? You can ask that same question in the Boltzmann machine. But what I've done is, again, I've taken away a whole bunch of connections, and you'll see why as we derive the learning procedure for the restricted Boltzmann machine. So let me define the energies, answer this question about the hidden units, and so on. So the energy in the energy-based model is just exactly what that graph represents. It's an Ising model. And what you've done is you've connected visible and hidden with weights. So those are your interactions in your Ising model. And what you can also add is a bias, which is just a local magnetic field that affects every spin individually. So E depends on your parameters, although I'm not going to write lambda on it most of the time. You could write E lambda, I don't know, X, H, where X is your visible and H is your hidden. We'll divide it up like that. Now let me use V. V, H. So in the Hopfield network, there was only one type of unit. Now I want to distinguish them. So what am I writing? The energy. So let me write this term first. These are all your weights. Those orange lines, V, I, H, I. I have biases. B for the visible, and I'll call them C for the hiddens. And now what I've defined, this is a small p, is a joint distribution between the visible and hidden units. And I have 1 over the partition function, e to the minus e v h. That defines the machine. Lambdas, in this case, are weights and biases. Okay, so it's still an energy-based model. It's just an Ising model. It looks like this. Okay, and the number of hidden units, I'm going to call them, I don't know what. Let's say there's n of them, small n and small m. So that these sums here, so j would run from 1 to n, and this would run from 1 to m. Okay? Just another representation. Again, I don't think the representation is necessarily what the interesting part of the machine is, besides the idea that you have a systematic way of converging. You know, you have a hyperparameter that's a number of hidden units that you can adjust before training, to basically test convergence of the machine. So I'll show you the convergence of Boltzmann machines for some typical physical problems. So I wrote some notes in the PDF that you guys should have access to. So these were used in industry. Because they have a good training algorithm. They have an efficient way of basically doing stochastic gradient descent on those lambda parameters. Learning. You could generally classify their industrial use, I think, in a couple different ways. One is as a generative model producing new elements not in your training set, so generating unseen data. So this is a model for a recommender system. So the famous example is the Netflix recommender system that was proposed by Hinton and his group back in, I think it's 2007, called collaborative filtering. So in that recommender system, the visible units are your own user rankings of movies as a softmax. So if you rank a movie out of 1 to 5, your visible units would be a softmax that represents your, so maybe this is Babe, Pig in the City, and you liked it 4 out of 5. This is some movie you didn't watch. This is some other one that you gave a 3 to. And then this one you hated. So the idea of a recommendation or recommender system is recommending movies that you haven't seen to you. So the way this is done in this collaborative filtering example is by connecting all these to a hidden or latent space, which models the association between different movies. And every user of Netflix would have a Boltzmann machine that looked like this. And you'd enter your rankings from 1 to 5 for all the movies that you've seen. And it's collaborative because what you do is share the weights and biases of the Boltzmann machines of other users that have seen these unseen movies. Once the neural network is trained, you basically generate new recommendations in the softmax. So maybe this one would be generated as high and this one would be generated as low. And so it's just the idea of generative modeling. It's the idea of producing data that hasn't been seen in your training set. So that's one of the uses of these things. That's a fun paper to read, by the way. I recommend it. The other use of these things in industry is to give you an interpretable latent space. So just the idea that the hidden units carry some information that's useful, basically. So topic modeling is one of the uses. And it's just the idea that you feed a document into one of these systems with a whole bunch of word possibilities, with a dictionary, which is your visible units. And then you explore latent space for some sort of hidden meaning. So I'm just mentioning this as sort of the second industrial use. I would say, I guess, interpretation. The idea is that the weights and biases, you know, strong weights, which connect words in the dictionary, give you some sort of idea of some sort of, you know, topic or semantic structure to the documents. But the most important use of restricted Boltzmann machines was as generative pre-training for deep neural networks. I'd say classifiers. Classifiers. The idea was that the latent space, you know, the hidden units, would then be fed into some sort of like feed-forward neural network. So you would train, you know, you'd feed in a bunch of data into the visible layer. You'd produce some sort of latent structure. You could generate the binary hidden units and feed these hidden units, which can in principle have a different dimension of state space, into something like a classifier. So what you're kind of doing is searching for a hidden structure, you're modeling that structure, and then you're feeding these into deep, you know, deeper feed-forward neural networks as sort of a pre-training step. With the advent of convolutional neural networks and everything in 2012 that can be trained in an efficient way for classification, Boltzmann machines aren't used anymore for this purpose. So this was all pre-2012. So now we're using them for something else. Questions?
So just looking at these two definitions of the energy functionals, it's not clear to me why you would be able to train these parameters but not those parameters.
True.
Okay. Why?
We're gonna do a whole class on the training. Next class is gonna be entirely dedicated to training.
What's H?
Hidden?
Yeah, but like how do you input it? Your data I think is V.
Right.
Right? So yeah. If you wanna know what the probability of P for some data, what do you plug in for H?
Right, you sample it. So let me discuss that now then. So let's go back to the energy functional, visible and hidden. Vi for any I is 0 or 1. Hi is 0 or 1. So during the training, so we're going to split up the use of a Boltzmann machine into two parts. It'll be training and sampling. OK, so it'll be training. And training, the goal is to update the parameters with stochastic gradient descent. And once you exhaust the training procedure, those things become stationary. And then we're going to generate new data. And so you can generate both visible and hidden units, you can imagine, right? So we're going to see how that works. So goal. Train. I don't know, I guess the parameters on a set of data drawn from just the visibles. And then after training is complete, sample or generate V and H, but with the goal of calculating new physical observables. So this is what's different about our use of a Boltzmann machine and some sort of Netflix nonsense, is that we're going to use our samples, okay, that are generated from a hopefully this, you know, generative model that correctly captures our data and generalizes well, to produce new physical observables. So if we're thinking of a quantum computer that's producing projective measurements in some basis, right, and we can measure some observable directly from that data, what we're going to do is we're going to use instead use those projective measurements to train a generative model, and then to calculate those observables directly from the generative model. And you're going to ask why, and hopefully you'll find out by the end of Wednesday. So let me just write down sort of our strategy for the next class, which will focus almost entirely on this question of training and what does this restriction give you. And you'll see exactly how it takes the training procedure and makes it tractable. And then on Wednesday, we'll talk about the possibilities for how to generate generalizations of physical observables from a trained RBM. So that's tomorrow. Oops. Given the data set, it's going to be visibles now, V1. This is how many measurements you can take from your quantum computer. Oh, what did I call this before? Big M?
Yeah.
So M is D then, right? So is that right? The size of D. Drawn from an unknown P. P visibles. Training means adjusting the parameters of the machine so remember we wanted small p, I'm just writing it bigger, small p of lambda x to approximately equal that p of v. But now we have a set of hidden units, so we have to trace over those. Oh, so that should be V. So what we need to do is take the joint distribution. We need to trace out the hidden units. And so that this thing should be approximately equal to big P of V. Or, in the training procedure, again, I'm going to call this P data, because that's all we have access to. So it's approximately equal to, the model could, not exactly be equal to the frequency distribution. And it's going to generalize well. So again, training is just finding these arguments. We have to deal with the latent space. So sampling the binary units of the latent space are a step in both training and generation or sampling. And I'll start this tomorrow, but this will be Wednesday. I'm going to call it sampling or generating. So the idea is that you're now treating a trained machine as a model that you can draw samples from stochastically. Okay. So the easiest case to imagine is you train it in some projective measurements in some basis. You can produce new projective measurements in that basis, you know, in the quantum computing language. Really what you're doing is generating unseen samples. So after training is complete, let's see. We're going to generate new samples of both V and H according to the joint distribution of the machine, which is this thing, small p lambda V H. And we're going to calculate estimators. OK, so an estimator will be, I'll define it as, if you have some observable O. An estimator for O, in the usual sense, drawn from this joint distribution. OK, so this will be, so let me just write the observable, actually, or the expectation value. So this would be V, H, Q, P lambda, V, H. So, oh, that's Q. QO, whatever I'm calling it, O. So for example, O could just be the energy of the machine. But you know, why do you want the energy of a machine, right? It's got this latent space, which is a hyperparameter. What we really want to do is just define an operator O over the visible space and calculate observables over that visible space alone. So the expectation value that we'll define will be, for this case, so act on the visibles alone. Then because I'm going to produce samples from the joint distribution, what I'm going to do is factor out this O from the double sum here, which will give me something like this, P of lambda VH. Right? But what I've done is I've just marginalized over H there, so that this thing here should be P of V, P of lambda V, right? And then this is basically the thing that I want, P of V, if I've done my training step well. So this will be, you know, an approximation of whatever that observable is over P V, hopefully. Note also that in the partition function, when I'm normalizing things, phi of V and H, P lambda V of H. I don't know if you can see this. If I marginalize over this thing, again, I just have V, P lambda. Okay, so that'll be our aim. It'll be to take a set of data, V, generalize it into a restricted Boltzmann machine that has this latent space. You know, effectively what we're going to do is train the joint distribution, sample from the joint distribution. That's our stationary distribution. We're going to use a Markov chain Monte Carlo method. So it's just like the Monte Carlo that you've learned. We're going to essentially throw away the samples of H after training. You don't use them. But you do use the samples produced by V in order to calculate expectation values through MC estimators in the usual way. Okay? So tomorrow we'll talk about training and we'll derive the structure of the Kullback-Leibler divergence, and we'll talk about why this restriction gives us a tractable training method. Questions?
Why would we expect these extra hidden variables to help us model a lot of data? Is there an intuitive reason?
Say I have an Ising model. I have data from some Ising model that has random weights.
In your black box?
Yeah. Yep. And I want to reconstruct the Ising model.
That can be fully represented by a Hopfield network.
Right.
So
then the Hopfield network, in that case, could be trained.
Well, in principle, you can, if you could magically do the training, yes. Uh-huh. The Hopfield network has a sufficient representational capacity for that.
Okay.
Absolutely. As does this. This has too much representational, the Boltzmann machine has too much representational capacity.
Right.
So just the intuition is you're increasing the number of parameters. So you're going to have all these local minima floating around. And those local minima, you've increased the number of those. The chances that you'll fall into a local minima that is a good approximation to the global minima is higher. Let me put it that way.
Okay.
Just probabilistically, it's just higher. But that has to do with details of the training algorithm, how you fall down the loss landscape.
Right?
And so it's not really easy to formalize, I think, why then increasing the number of parameters helps. But that's basically the intuition. Then what we do is we take away all the connections of the Hopfield network. And then we need some way of now adding parameters to the model, and the way we do it is through the hidden. So I could have just done it like that without introducing the Boltzmann machine.
It's kind of like introducing some sort of like a dual lattice that mediates the interactions or something.
Yeah, absolutely. So the point is, if you have what you're talking about, say an Ising model that in the physical black box has a bond here, that's mediated just by two weights. So if you have a classical Ising model, like say with n bonds, you need you need n hidden units. You need one hidden unit per bond, and to fully represent the Ising model.
So normally in the Ising model, you have a plus one and a minus one.
Yep.
And here we've got ones and zeros, so you can actually represent less, I believe, because
you could reformulate this as minus ones and plus ones.
Yeah.
It's just that all the.
But then you get more representation.
It's still binary. Like the weights can take any value.
No, because the weights can't. It doesn't matter what the weight is if you have a 0, 0, or a 0, 1, or a 1, 0.
Without thinking too hard, I claim that it doesn't matter if it's 0, 1, or plus or minus 1, but then the structure, the energy, and the structure of the conditional distributions that we'll calculate will change. And so I'm not sure how that affects it. I don't think we've ever successfully made a Boltzmann machine of the plus or minus 1 energy. But it should be, it should have the same representational capacity, I would think.
The variables can be mapped, just like if you have Ising.
Yeah.
If you have variables that are 0, 1, twice the variable minus 1 will give you a minus 1 or a plus 1.
I mean, it's like a classification problem. You can formalize it with plus and minus 1 for a perceptron, but you can do 1 and 0.
Right.
And it still can tell you whether you're correctly classifying or not.
What we're going to calculate is a conditional probabilities that look like this, p, say, h equals 0 for some h. So I think the bottom line is it's just a matter of how you normalize these conditional probabilities that we'll deal with tomorrow. But I think it should be exactly the same otherwise. We always convert our data to binary before we throw it in there.
What's like the downfall for this Boltzmann machine? I mean, that recommendation system was beaten by an ensemble method, which is like 50 years old, something.
I don't know. People have all sorts of intuition for why Boltzmann machines aren't being used anymore. Basically, empirically, they just found that other things beat their performance. But I don't know the key ingredient. I've thought about this lots, because people ask us all the time, why are we still using Boltzmann machines? Number one, I can derive everything from scratch, which I like, because it's an explicit representation of the probability distribution. Like explicitly you have the energy functional defining P of lambda, which is I like. Lots of these other methods might not be explicit. Michael Albergo will talk about implicit generative modeling. But in terms of like why contrastive divergence, which is the learning procedure we'll learn tomorrow, isn't as efficient as other methods, I mean, who knows, man? I think there's lots still to explore in terms of Boltzmann machines, especially for, I think, physical applications. So if someone could answer that question to me, I'd be happy.
Aside from the fact that you can put it on a quantum computer, because...
You can do this with any generative model. You can take projective measurements and put them in any generative model, as far as I understand.
Well, I mean, like, the energy function itself.
You could do that. There's such a thing as a quantum Boltzmann machine, where you have an energy functional that has quantum, that has off-diagonal elements in the Hamiltonian. Those off-diagonal elements don't train using the procedure we're going to learn, though, tomorrow. So if you want to do that, you have to come up with an entirely new training procedure. And one of the points of machine learning is that these methods that we're talking about, and especially in terms of training, are empirically shown to be, I guess, tractable in a way that gives you, you know, good generalization. So you'd have to redo all of this machine learning research that's been done since, you know, the 80s, in some sense, in order to devise training schemes for them.
What's the numerical problem that, I think it's a numerical problem probably, that would stop you from just exactly summing over all H's?
Exactly summing over all H's?
Yes.
Just the fact that that Hilbert space is too large. You have to take a trace, right, over an exponential Hilbert space. Think of it like that, 2 to the n, or 2 to the whatever.
But don't you essentially just do some exponential of sum by product of Hausch or similar function? If you just substitute zeros and ones there, or
well, okay, there's some models that can be solved that trace can be solved exactly, like a mean field model, and using, you know, in the mean. But in most cases, you can't do that trace exactly. Just like you learn in StatMech, right? You can do in the mean field theory, you can do the trace exactly, but in, you know, an interacting, you know, Ising model, like a Phi-4 theory, you can't do that trace exactly. So that's the whole field of statistical mechanics, is basically the idea that these traces are intractable because of the exponential size of, if you will, your Hilbert space. So it's the same problem here. So what we're going to do is sample, important sample, the hidden and the visible units. But, you know, we're going to important sample the hidden units with the goal of somehow taking that trace implicitly. So it's going to be like a Monte Carlo method. Cool? Get out of here. See you tomorrow.